My name's Professor Steve Hall, and I'm talking to you from Newcastle upon Tyne.
Tell us a bit about your background, Steve.
Well, I'm a social scientist by trade since the 1980s. I have a reasonable grasp of economic history, anthropologically informed sociology, but I worked in criminology departments for over 30 years, looking at fraud, crime. So I approached economics from that angle, which was a very interesting and revealing perspective. I published a number of books, articles, and I retired in 2017.
Okay, so what's your latest book?
My latest book is the second edition of Revitalizing Criminological Theory, and that's out on May the 30th of this year. But I suppose that the book that got most attention was The Death of the Left, which I think you've had a look at in the past.
Right. It seems the obvious thing to ask you about, Steve, is this link between crime and finance, 2008. But we actually just spoke last week to Pierre Jovanovic, who's just got a book out in France naming the criminals and explaining that the evidence is all there, that they knew that the products that they were selling were designed to fail and to make them a lot of money. And so this is he describes it as the biggest heist in history, where every day the press and everyone else was lying to the public the whole year, 2008. So what's your take on what happened in the big bailouts?
Well, there's a huge history behind this. And this is what I think an awful lot of people don't understand. Of course, it's a hidden history that's been obscured quite deliberately, I think. We can take it back to the 14th century, where the legal law and cultural norms were shifted over from the debtor to the creditor. Whereas, the creditor was seen as the potential villain, the Christian, both the Judaic Christian and Islamic religions had laws against usury, against exploiting people, taking too much interest, apart from commercial loans, but lending money to ordinary people was seen as a sin. But in the 14th century, the law was shifted over to the creditor. You had the appearance of debtors' prisons. You know, this famous style like Newgate Prison, where people who were in debt were shipped in prison. So it was a sort of caveat emptor scenario where the debtor was seen to be the one who had to be careful and the one who would be liable to prosecution if they didn't pay the debts back. Of course, if you have a credit card or anything like that, you miss a payment, you get a letter the following morning. But try getting money out of these people if you need it. So the whole moral and legal owner shifted over from the debtor to the creditor, and they have been running the show ever since. Of course, we have the famous East India Company finance houses. Well, the City of London was set up in 1067 by King William's financiers. East India Company based there from the 17th century. Financial flows going all over the world. So they became established, and they started sponsoring politicians and getting their hooks into the political system after 1688 Parliament. Of course, setting up the Bank of England in 1694, and the relationship between politics and financiers became basically an old pals act. We had the idea of selling bonds, this notion, beginning in the Netherlands in the 17th century. And this basically those the savings accounts for reserve capital. So that's an old pound. We don't even need to sell them. So the whole emphasis, was shifted over onto the credit, what Michael Hudson calls the creditor class. So when they do something wrong, now we all know in 2008, and by the way, the left, as we argue in our book, had no answer to this. So it still hasn't, with the likes of Reeves and Starmer in charge. In 2008, basically what they were doing was selling mortgages. They were lending money they knew to people who they knew couldn't pay it back, and they had these tranches which were composed of what they knew would be bad debts, and they were supposed to be buried in what they thought were good debts, which would see the whole thing through. And of course, I wouldn't say they knew it was going to collapse, but it was a big risk, if you see what I mean. People can't afford.
Well, okay, well, this is the interesting thing about Pierre's new book. What he explained to me last week is that through things like WikiLeaks and other avenues and freedom of information requests, that there are now enough emails from the period running up to 2008 to prove this. But anyway, his book hasn't actually, it's not out yet. It was at the printers when he was raided last weekend at his home and his publisher was raided.
Oh, dear. Really?
So, yeah. So, anyway, so how does this translate into the sort of politics and the economics of what happened in 2008, you know, to the public? Because we've seen a big difference since. The government doesn't seem to have any money to spend on anything anymore, whether it's painting the road, trimming back the bushes so that you can see a road sign, public toilets closing. You know, there's been a collapse, really, in state infrastructure.
Yes. But, you know, the issue here is that the government is a sovereign currency issue, and it has as much money as it needs, up to the point of inflation. And even inflation is determined by price rises. So the government.
But hang on. The Bank of England has been printing money, hasn't it, Steve? I thought ever since 2008.
Yeah, but it's been going into the reserve accounts of the banks. So it hasn't been used for public purpose. It was used to bail out the banks.
Hang on, you're reminding me. I think it was John McDonnell talked about the quantitative easing for the people.
Well, it's quantitative easing. It was a term invented by Richard Werner, the economist, the German-British economist. And it was basically to bail out the banks. So that money hasn't been used for public purpose. It's simply disappeared into the bank's reserve account.
So you're saying that's a choice. That's a choice they've made.
Everything's a political choice. Now, as I say, the state's a sovereign currency, so you can choose what it wants to do with the money. But, of course, don't forget, a lot of this sovereign currency is issued by private bank loans. Private banks don't issue their customers' savings. They keep them for clearance, settlement, and interbank lending. What they do is that they create new money every time they make a loan, so they're actually increasing the money supply. At the moment, it's around about, don't quote me on this because I haven't looked at the figures recently, but it's about 40% of the money is issued by the state free, and 60%, somewhere 55-60%, is issued by private banks for interest, as interest-bearing loans. Now, who do you think the private banks want to be in charge of creating new money? If they issue it for interest payments, you know, and the state can issue it free. And it's obvious, isn't it? The private banking industry wants to be in charge of issuing currency. So it wants to reduce the amount of money. So when they go on about big government and Doge and all of this, what they're doing is they're simply trying to take away as much of the state's ability to issue currency as possible and to issue it themselves as private loans, for which they charge compound interest, and that's their business. And as they've been in their business for a long time, I mean, you read the economist Michael Hudson, probably the best on this. He traces this struggle back 4,500 years. Private landowners issuing their own currency. And the state, the palace economies, the old Bronze Age palace economies, of course, could issue their currency free. There was an argument of Julius Caesar with his landowning class. It goes back so long, this struggle. It underpins the class struggle. It undercuts the class struggle.
Am I right in thinking that it was also involved in the US War of Independence, that the Americans were fed up with having their money system controlled by the Brits?
Yes, and Ben Franklin introduced colonial scrip, which was their own currency, and they issued it freely. And not only, it's a pity they had to spend it on war, because they also used it for everyday transactions, and American economy boomed under Ben Franklin's colonial scrip. As soon as Franklin was out of power, and others came in, then the bankers honed in on this, and they started to issue their own private currency. And of course, with the political relationships, they put in politicians who agree with them, and of course the media's on their side as well. Now, the next person to issue sovereign currency was, of course, Abraham Lincoln, the greenbacks for the Civil War. Again, pity for it's used for war, but it can be used for any public purpose, and you know what happened to him, don't you?
Yeah. So What about, we've had the Rich List this week from the Sunday Times, chatting to Kevin Cahill, who was one of the founding journalists on the Sunday Times last week, Steve. He makes it clear that the King controls the Crown Estate. He appoints the people that run it. He makes decisions about it. There's also, of course, the seabed of Britain, which is about three times the size of Britain, which is being used to make lots of money from these wind farms. So what do you make of their real wealth? Chatting to Phil Bevan, he was saying that actually he thinks that a lot of the, historically, the British royal family still controls quite a lot of the United States wealth by the back door. And I've heard that myself through someone who had contacts at Coutts Bank, a similar thing, that the royal family have got a massive interest in the United States. So we always have this debate, don't we, about who's really in charge, Britain or America? Is Britain controlling America by the back door? The LaRouche people in the States always say, oh, the Brits are really in charge over here. But if you look at it dispassionately, say, from the moon, it does look as if the Americans are running the show.
Well, it's a transatlantic, you know, an Atlanticist partnership, whereas I think Phil's right that, of course, the Crown's territory, which was vast, was the asset of last resort, along with the government's ability to tax the population, which is, of course, what America rebelled against. That was the core of their revolutionary movement, was to no taxation without representation. So I think Phil's right that the Crown territory is being the asset. It's not a liquid asset. You can't sell Canada, you know. Don't forget, we only gave up formal jurisdiction over Canada in 1982.
Someone needs to tell Donald Trump that, don't they?
Donald tried to buy it, of course, you know, which is, you know, Donald thinks everything is for sale. Someone knows the price of everything, the value of nothing. And this is an indication of their commercial interest taking over. But I think Phil's right, you know, the City of London, the huge financial flows which started in the Eurodollar market in the 1950s, which were an attempt to evade Keynes's capital controls. You know, Keynes said one of the things that Keynes argued was that nations need to keep capital, or the bulk of it, in their own nations, invest in their own industry. Now, Britain's been suffering from disinvestment from the 1960s, and this is because, of course, they evaded the capital controls by circulating around the Eurodollar market and investing it where they want. This is the British Empire. Neoliberalism is the British Empire rolled out worldwide. And I've had conversations with Phil about who's in charge, and I think I partially agree with them that the City of London, simply because of its experience, it's been there since 1067. Nobody knows more about financial flows than the apparatchiks who work in the City of London. But it's a partnership, Wall Street and the City of London, controlling these flows. And what they don't want, and what they desperate want, don't want to happen, is what China's doing now, which is issuing currency through its central bank, its policy banks. They're building new metro stations, thorium salt reactors.
Well, look, they're doing really well. This. Yes. So why don't we want this? It's obvious that this is what you've got to do if you want to compete with the Chinese and bring up living standards.
Well, we did that, and during the Keynesian era, and we all prospered very well until the stagflation in the 70s, which was skullduggery, of course. You know, a lot of skullduggery going on there, banks sloshing around too much cheap bank credit in the late 60s. Healy's credit swaps, and then his IMF, totally unnecessary IMF loan. I think possibly there are a lot of compromised politicians coming on there into the scene in the 1970s. Once Wilson went, I think the Labour Party became compromised immediately after that. Of course, the private investors, the private equity, the big banks, the hedge funds don't want the public currency to be issued because they want to invest for their interest payments. That's how they make their money. Compound interest.
Simple, yeah.
And they want, it's so simple at the root. Yeah, they want all that money flowing into their coffers. And then when they amass these huge capital reserves, what do? They buy bonds with it, and they screw more money out of the state with the bond yields. Yeah. It's a scam. It's a giant scam.
Okay, well, look, I mentioned the King. There's all sorts of different views on the extent to which the government, Keir Starmer, is really in charge, or he is. We live in a monarchy, and each monarch has a different kind of character. you know, different individual monarchs. What would you make of the relationship between the cabinet, for example, the cabinet and King Charles? What power does he have, or is he really just a sort of someone to show off to the tourists?
Neither. There's powers in the city of London.
Well, I mean, excuse me. Isn't the City of London... Okay, so who runs the City of London, then?
The City of London Corporation.
Okay, who appoints people there?
They appoint themselves.
Right, and who are they?
They're bankers. They're big global financiers. Mm. And they all have their offices in there. The first offices of the East India Company were in Leadenhall Street in the City of London, for instance. And Bank of England at Threadneedle Street. This is a state within a state, Tony. It's not our state. We don't control it. It's been there since 1067 when King William gave them at the square mile. He said, look after my taxes, make me rich, make sure I can go to war and oppress the people. I have plenty of money to do so. And they did that, you know, and they've been there ever since. It's the oldest, the most powerful, most influential financial centre in the world. And there have been documentaries made about it, you know, very good spider's web documentaries like that. But no one takes any notice of it. No one seems to be interested in the fact that there's this huge set of this huge financial centre, which has no power over it, no jurisdiction. And of course, they sponsor their own MPs. Margaret Thatcher's husband was a city financier.
Well, what about Theresa May's husband? Yeah, that's right. He was
John Major. You know, they're basically pulling the politicians' strings, using bond yields, using of course the global foreign exchange markets. All they've got to do is sell a few billion worth of pounds off, and the value of the pound makes our imports more expensive. We're import dependent, and they can crush businesses. And any government that does that will be out quicker than Liz Truss.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Right. Yes. So anyway, look, we're in May. 1st of May, we had local elections and a by-election here. The Reform Party, Reform UK, Nigel Farage's latest iteration after the things like Tommy Robinson infiltrated UKIP, and so he decided to depart from there. I know you've written something recently quite interesting about the rise of Farage. What do you put all this down to, and what are the pitfalls?
Well, Farage is a fake, a former commodity broker in another city board, who's pretending to be a nationalist and offering something that looks vaguely on the surface like a neo-mercantilist package, you know, invest in Britain. But at the same time, out of the other side of his mouth, he's talking about financial flows, free capital, globalism, and you know, all of the accoutrement of global finances. He's a total fake. Reform is a fake. And they've moved into the vacuum created by the complete inability of the left to do anything about the austerity programs that followed the great financial crash in 2008. But Reeves is supposed to be going over, you know, wooing Larry Fink to invest private equity. And where is it? Where are the new factories? Where are the refurbished? Where's the railway? You know, refurbished railways. What's happening? Where are the wind farms? What's happening to this country? It's still suffering from disinvestment. But nobody's interested in investing here because we have very high labour costs, very high energy costs, and transport costs. So they'd rather invest somewhere where costs are low. It's so simple. It's so obvious. And this is what they do. And the reform will make no difference to anything whatsoever. They'll be out another 4 or 5 years, and people will be wondering why they voted for them, just like they're wondering why they voted for Starmer now. And they'll be looking for the wheel in the next lot of puppets to support the you know, global finance capital.
Yeah, but so if you were Reeves, and you had a good set of like armed bodyguards.
I need a lot of them, you know, because they did try to shoot Roosevelt as well, you know, 16 days before his inauguration ceremony. They tried to shoot him because they knew he was going to put the clamps down on the global banking industry after they'd failed so badly in 1929. That's why he got in.
So imagine yourself sitting in number 11 and... Yeah. with your armed guards. What are you going to do, Steve? What should she be doing?
Well, what she should be doing is trying to set up better trading relationships with the BRICS economies, and using massive public investment, I mean huge public investment, to reboot our economy. We should nationalise railways, utilities, steel. They're in such a desperate situation that even Farage and his crew are arguing for temporary nationalisation of the steel industry to get it back on its feet. You can't run a country without steel, without a metals industry. You know, steel and aluminium, you need these things. And we need our own health care equipment. So we need judicious reindustrialization. We don't upset the Chinese. We don't be making cheap electronics goods and plastic dinosaurs for the kids that are cheaper from China. So we want decent trading relationships. And we need to reboot our economy with public investment the way the Chinese are doing it. But of course, as soon as one single whiff of that, and the foreign exchange traders will attack and devalue the currency, because at the moment we're import dependent.
So as Chancellor, what would you do about the city? Obviously, you can't just fiddle around.
I wouldn't get a chance because I'd be out within a month.
Well, okay. So, how is it possible to do anything about the City of London? We just have to live with it.
I would like to do things with the City of London. But I don't want to talk about them now.
Right, okay.
I'd turn it into a theme park. I would actually employ some of the brighter ones, because some of them know how the system works. Hmm. They're not intellectuals, but they know how the system works. And employ some of them, give them a decent salary, and employ them in our public finance system, so that we can actually reboot the economy. I wouldn't get rid of private investment altogether. They can play catch-up if they can offer good terms, and if they can offer to small and medium enterprises and help to get the smaller businesses off the ground, then let them do it. But we need... this is the way China does, and this is the way we did it from 1945 up until the stagflation of the 1970s. The problem we had in that period was the money flowing out of the country, circumventing, avoiding capital controls through the euro-dollar market. If that had happened, if we'd invested properly like Germany did, we'd be in a much, much better situation. But we at the moment are in deep doo-doo, and we need to do something quite serious to leave ourselves out.
But that's not happening, is it? As you've just explained, what do you make of the whole business with Liz Truss then? Did you think she actually was onto doing something fairly sensible and was bounced out by the city?
No, but that's not why they got rid of her. The reason they got rid of her was she threatened to use public and a lot of public money to tide people over the difficult period that would obviously transpire as she was trying to woo private investment with tax cuts. So if you cut the tax, of course, you've got to issue more money to pay people benefits and try and stop them rioting in the streets. So she was doing, it was a stupid idea, trying to woo private capital into a country with high labour and high transport and energy, massive energy, with the highest energy costs in Europe, would never have worked. But that's not why they attacked her. They attacked her because they knew she would use public investment, use public money, I beg your pardon, sovereign currency, to tide us over. If a socialist government got in and promised to do exactly the same for a sensible programme, like public investment, nationalisation, and also boosting effective demand so small businesses could start operating again, and increase confidence in small business, then they would do exactly the same. They would attack and they would, devalue our currency, cause inflation. The bond vigilantes would attack. But we don't need the bonds. We don't need to sell bonds, technically. When the central bank, of course, can buy them back. They're not the real problem. The real problem are the Forex traders. Don't forget, we're up against a monster, Tony. In the bond markets, the Forex markets, and the stock markets that trade over $160 trillion worth of currency every day. That's the size of the monster. I call it the Death Star. It's circulating around the world. And it can pounce on anyone who does the wrong thing. And we're up against a massive, powerful enemy. And we need to do some serious stuff. And the way that I think the Chinese model works, we're obviously in a different situation. We don't have a huge manufacturing base. So we'd have to think our way through that. But we need some serious politics to take on the Death Star, and I don't see any of the parties even anywhere close to the sort of policies we need to reboot our economy and put our nation back on its feet.
Yeah, well, what about the big changes going on in the financial markets? There is this French documentary, Banking Nature. The idea is that a lot of the future guarantees will be ownership of natural resources, ownership of the countryside, even things like endangered species will be given a value. What do you make of all that?
You know, it's a strange sort of value. So it's rather like a carbon credit. It's the value of trying to look after nature by privatizing it. We've had this mythology since the tragedy of the commons, you know, which was mooted in the 18th century, the idea that if you have anything free, if you have public land, that then people will abuse it, and you know, which is absolutely not true. And so you need to privatize things to give people the incentive to look after them. So what they'll do is they'll set up another market, like a derivatives market, with the same sort of principles, trading all of these credits they get for looking after nature. And they won't do anything sensible with it. They'll basically look after the bits that are pretty and pillage the bits that they need for minerals and agricultural resources. They're busy turning Argentina right now into a resource colony, indebted because it owes debts in a foreign currency, in dollars. If you owe debts in a foreign currency, you're absolutely snookered. But of course, we don't. Our bonds are in pounds sterling, so we have the advantage there. So what they'll do is they've turned this into another derivatives model, but that does show you how desperate they are, because behind all of this is the problem they face is that their profits from industry from 1946 have been in free fall. They set up the derivatives markets based on asset inflation, you know, the housing market, which people thought was just going to go up and up forever. It's a stupid idea, of course. They're based on asset inflation, set up these derivatives markets where they're basically selling people's debts to each other. These are the tranches full of the debts, and also selling insurance schemes to insure their risk. So they'll basically do the same. They're trying to do the same with nature. Well, that does indicate that they're in a desperate situation because they've got all this reserve capital floating around the place and nowhere for it's all dressed up and nowhere for it to go. That's why they're trying to privatize, commoditize, and privatize every damn thing, from sex to the Amazon rainforest, everything.
And what the air, even the air we breathe.
Well, Robert Tressel said that they would do that, didn't he, in his novel 100 years ago, said they would do that if they could. Fortunately, they can't do that, but they would do that if they could. They need to commoditize everything. And they're in a desperate situation, you know, but they're making us more desperate because they're just keeping their capital up there, floating around, looking for bond yields, looking for, you know, trading in currency markets, and they're not investing it in the sort of stuff that people need to satisfy.
Well, how about why is it that the London finance correspondents for all the mainstream press, the broadcasters, etc., don't seem to get this, Steve?
Well, I don't know them, and what I would say is that certainly for the past 300 years that they've all been in some way either ideologically or financially in the pockets of the upper finances.
Might simply be that if anyone starts to get anywhere close to it, then they get their P45. Might be that simple.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the editorial control. They say, well, you know, start mentioning this in the national newspapers and you're out of the job, maybe.
Yeah, I know. There was a columnist in the FT that talked about the Bilderbergers, and he was hoiked out straight away. Right, that was the 1970s, C. Gordon Tedder.
That's right, and that chap not so long ago talked about after the financial crash, talked about the fact that the state borrowing is different to private borrowing, and never saw him again.
You talking about this privatisation of nature, which I introduced there, it sounds to me almost like the old 18th century enclosures, even on a sort of on steroids, you know, another dimension to that.
Well, it is. I mean, the enclosure, I have to go much further back. They began in the 14th century, I think, enclosures.
Well, they accelerated after the Civil War. They really accelerated.
They did. And they were, you know, they were looking to privatise it. The principle was improvement, wasn't it? The improvement movement. This idea that if you privatise land, then whoever owns the land, in order to earn a buck from it, will do good stuff with it. They'll, you know, they'll improve the agricultural yield. They'll, you know, they'll invest in new farm machinery and all the rest of it. You know, till which a certain extent that works, of course. But you know, if you privatising, I'm not particularly against family farms. I don't see a problem with that. But if you privatise everything, common land, everything to do with nature, the seabed, the seawater, the rainforests, as you say, that they would, you know, privatise the air if they could, then you start to encroach on the commons. And you start, then you get a situation where people, you know, the ordinary citizen has no power and influence and no rights left, for, no birthright for the common land. And that's a situation that is intolerable.
Well, you say that, and there were some people that pointed out that the reason that last summer's riots, one of the points of that was that the people living in many of the cities where these riots took place, they don't feel like they actually own anything there anymore, that nothing is theirs, so they're quite happy to go out and start smashing things up.
Well, yes, I mean, you can see this alienation has reached a critical point there. It's reached a flash point where the people at the bottom end of this, who have been promised this, that, and the other for the past, what was it, 46 years of neoliberalism, they've just seen their lives deteriorating. They've seen their environment deteriorating, their housing stock deteriorating, the jobs that are crap jobs in the service centre, part-time, insecure. You know, they're trying to sell each other tattoos and ice creams. You know, it's compared to the security of the industrial work that they had before that, and they still hear tales of that from the older generation. Then they just don't feel they're part of the country. They feel as though they're totally disenfranchised, and they have no left-wing political party to fly the flag for them. You know, the Labour Party is completely compromised by global finance. And so they vote Reform, thinking that Reform is going to restore their country to some sort of normality. But little do they know, Reform is simply another global...
Well, okay, so Britain's family silvers have well and truly been sold off, almost all of it. Many people think of Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s when it comes to privatisation. Are there one or two things that she did which really accelerated this whole process?
Well, sure, you know, privatising everything, shutting down. Well, the first thing she did in 1980 was close the huge steelworks in the town where I was brought up, in Concert County. And then she went on to try to create a culture of the entrepreneur, like Ayn Rand's John Gold character, you know, it wasn't the Fountainhead, it's awful books that she wrote, where everyone started to see themselves as an investor, a property owner, and an entrepreneur, rather than a citizen and a worker. And she changed the soul of the country. And that's what she did. She was quite forthright about that. She said that in as many words. I want to change the soul of Britain. I want to turn Britain into a nation of entrepreneurs, of Alan Sugars and the Apprentice and all the rest of these awful shows that we see on TV. So she did that. And everyone got the idea, you know, that they had to own things. Everything had to be privatised. And so many people still believe that that's...
Well, I'm not sure people did. I mean, we all saw the... was it Tell Sid advert or something, where but people realised, look, here's just a load of free money. You just buy up a few, whatever it is, BT shares or whatever, and you make a few after you sell them after a few months, and you've made yourself a small fortune. And people were kind of buying into it because they could make a bit of, you know, it's like I say, free money.
Well, of course, yeah, but I mean, they don't have to buy into it ideologically; they just have to do it. And by doing that, you know, that's how everything was privatised. From, you know, the post office, everything, telecom, everything was privatised. Steel industry was privatised. And so that's what you want to do. Whether people believe in it in a committed way, like they have a passion for it, it's irrelevant, as long as they just do it. And now some of them are wondering if it's whether it was a good thing or not. But, you know, Tony, a lot of people just don't think about it. They don't know. You know, I once taught students in British universities who didn't know who Tony Blair was, never mind Mark Thatcher.
Well, yes, but some people do take an interest in history and
I don't know. I just don't know.
There are some. I mean,
Yeah.
We want to know how we got to the situation. Anyway, look, finally, I'd just like to ask you where you think all this is leading. It's not looking good, particularly with the European Union. We're sort of getting back in bed with the EU, which is really not a democratic system at all. And also the potential war with the Russians. There's no interest, it seems to me, amongst the British population for having a war with the Russians. But there certainly is within the elite in this country, as well as our support for the genocide in Gaza. So where is this all heading, do you think? Doesn't look good, does it?
It doesn't look good at all. I mean, I find my crystal ball getting ever murkier every day. I'm not sure where it's leading, because we're in an interregnum. We're in an interregnum, just as the collapse of the Bronze Age saw us 500 years until the Axial Age dawned upon us. So things happen a lot faster these days, so no doubt things will happen at an increased pace. I honestly don't know where this is going. I think that the war with Russia is unlikely. I think the military-industrial complex is trying to insinuate itself into Europe and make a lot of money out of the
scale. Well, look, I mean, let me just say something about Russia, because I've been reading some stuff recently which indicates that the whole point of needling the Russians the whole time is to stop them interfering in Syria and the Middle East, which has been quite successful last year, as Syria has just collapsed, which was an old Russian stronghold.
It was, yes, certainly. And they did that by appointing these rather traditional, shall we call them traditional Sunni Muslims, putting them into power in Syria, which collapsed the whole country. And yes, they're trying to push the Russians back. They've got hundreds of military bases around Russia and China. They don't want Russian and Chinese influence on the world. Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, where they get Africa, for instance, Burkina Faso, suddenly realised they get better deals from the Russians and the Chinese than do from the Americans. So they wanted to limit the extent of these initiatives. But I don't think they'll succeed. I think BRICS is on the rise. I think they have their new BRICS payment system. They don't need to use SWIFT. I think that they're using credit swaps and also a form of bartering, using their own currencies. I think eventually they'll beat dollar domination, so they don't owe debts in dollars. And I think the BRICS is on the rise, and I don't think there's a lot America can do to stop them. I think Britain, the best thing would be a divorce from America, and I think we should set up our own trading relationships with Europe, with Russia, with the BRICS countries, and try to move towards a more sensible, peaceful world.
Well, it's difficult to see that now, although there has been a bit of a rift, doesn't there, of course, between Starmer and Trump. But anyway, as individuals, Steve, what can we do about all this?
Well, I'm a member of the Workers' Party, so I think what we need is a united socialist party, not a left-wing party, because that vague term doesn't really mean anything much these days. It tends to be about liberalise. It tends to be about cultural relationships and cultural norms and values rather than about hard economics. We need a unified left focused on hard economics to put these things to the population and try to convince them that we need a serious change of direction before anything can happen. You know, anything that will benefit them can happen.
And how about in our daily lives, though? Because it's a bit difficult, isn't it? Figuring out what to do, whether to rent or to buy, to get a job, what sort of job. Or maybe, as a lot of young people do, they just go abroad.
Hey, I go abroad. A lot of people moving into, you know, there's still jobs in IT if you're properly trained. The service industry, people have adapted to the service industry. I don't know how. You know, I see a lot of people running about in bars and restaurants. The service industry has recovered somewhat since COVID. They're just sort of hanging on to whatever they can get. And you can't blame them, because what's happening to them is they're not being taught throughout the worst university economics departments, which they've got to be the real culprits.
Hang on, I thought that's where you used to work.
No, it isn't. I worked in the social science department.
Ah, right, okay.
Well, social science departments are just bad, I suppose, these days. We really need some honesty and transparency in the way that we educate our population. They don't understand that we have a fiat currency. They think that they still believe in the quantity theory of money, the idea that if you produce more money, it causes inflation automatically, without people putting up prices, and, you know, you just cause inflation, which is, even Milton Friedman, the architect of the, well, he wasn't the architect, it was Irving Fisher in the 1930s, came up with this nonsense. He was the one who publicised it on behalf of the neoliberals. It doesn't work like that. And we need to dispel these myths. We need to educate people. We need people to know that we have a sovereign currency. We have our own government, which should be our elected representatives who are there to look after our interests, not the interests of the City of London. That we have this money. We can invest it in any way we want, up to the limit of inflation, and that depends on how productive our investments are. They have to be productive, we know that. And we can reboot the economy. We can do that, yeah. If the global financier, the Death Star, would get off our backs, we could do what China have done over the past 40 years, and every nation in this world could start to reboot their economy using their own currency with sensible trading relations, and we could have a far more peaceful and rational world if we could just get rid of this incubus, this succubus off our backs, this global financial system, and start to do things in a sensible way.
Well, fascinating. Steve, can you just let listeners know where they can find and follow you, and maybe a couple of your more recent books, and more accessible ones, preferably?
Well, the most accessible, I think, is The Death of the Left. If they read The Death of the Left, book I wrote with my long-term writing partner, Simon Winlow, Professor Winlow, then they'll read about all of this and much more. We show you where the left went wrong, where we can start putting it right again, and what we can do economically to try to reboot our economy and try to forge much better, friendlier and more productive relationships with nations abroad. So The Death of the Left is a one. I'm on X, of course, pontificating every other day about this sort of thing. And some of my posts have got an awful lot of attention. I'm trying to explain all this in simplest terms possible. So follow me on X, and I hope that someday we can find some sort of unification amongst the left with a much harder economics, and do something positive.
And meanwhile, we're all looking forward to the next Farage government.
They'll be in, they'll be out. Nothing will happen.
Okay, Steve Hall, thanks very much.
Cheers. Thanks, Tony.